The final case for oral argument this morning was in the matter of the estate of Blair Hamilton, deceased. For the appellant, Lyndon Hart, we have Ms. McLean Thompson, from attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellate estate, we have Mr. Dwight Guru, attorney from Belle Fourche. As I mentioned before, Justice Cohen Camp is not here personally because he's recovering from surgery, but is listening to the arguments on the internet and is also fully participating in the cases this term. With that, Ms. Thompson, you may proceed. You have 20 minutes. Let's see. I've probably been pulling me down a little bit. Okay.
Just a little bit. May it please the court. My name is McLean Thompson, and I'm an attorney representing Lynn Hart in this matter. With the court's permission, I will first address the merits of this appeal, and then we'll address the motion to dismiss. On October 10, 2009, Lynn Hart witnessed the tragic death of his friend, Blair Hamilton, a death which occurred mere footsteps from where Hart was sitting. Being present at his friend's tragic death has caused Hart to suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder and psychological trauma. Hart wishes to pursue a claim against the estate of Blair Hamilton for his cause of action, which arose at or after the death of the decedent. After Hart's attorney notified the attorney for the estate that Hart was considering filing a potential claim against the estate, Hart was told that his claim was barred pursuant to SDCL 29A-3-803A, prompting Hart to file a petition with the court to extend time to file a creditor's claim pursuant to SDCL 29A-3-804C. The lower court denied Hart's petition. The lower court erred when it denied Hart's petition because SDCL 29A-3-803A does not apply to Hart's claim. The rules of statutory construction dictate that SDCL 29A-3-803A should be given its plain meaning. In fact, this court stated in Western Consolidated Co-op versus Pew that the court must confine itself to the words used in the statutes, that words and phrases in a statute must be given their plain meaning. When the language in a statute is clear, certain, and unambiguous, there is no reason for construction, and the court's only function is to declare the meaning of the statute as clearly expressed. SDCL 29A-3-803 states in pertinent part that all claims against the decedent's estate which arose before the death of the decedent. The plain meaning of SDCL 29A-3-803A shows that the non-claim provisions of that statute apply only to claims which arose before the death of the decedent, not to claims which arose at the time of or after the death of the decedent.
So doesn't it really come down to a medical determination of when this individual died? Isn't this a factual call or is it a legal one?
Your Honor, I would argue that it's a legal call. If there was no death, this claim would not be here.
But are we going to say as a matter of law when this person died?
I would argue, Your Honor, that it's either the determining point at Blair Hamilton's death or after Blair Hamilton's death when this psychological trauma arose.
Could it arose when he fired the gun before the bullet killed him? I mean, this is just a microsecond, and this
yep.
is part of the difficulty I see in this case, is it all happens so instantaneously. That's why I asked, is this a factual determination or a legal one?
Your Honor, I would argue again that it's a legal determination, because if the facts of this case and the relationship between these two people are that they're best friends, there's facts in the record that show that they had a tendency to drink with each other, to wrestle with each other, to play these sorts of games that happened. It just happened that on this instance, on this day, those games turned into tragic reality. And because of that reality, whether it's at the instant of his death or the psychological trauma occurred because Hamilton is no longer around because of his death, we have a claim which arose either at the time or after Hamilton's death, not before. The South Dakota Probate Code was primarily adopted from the Uniform Probate Code. However, it was not adopted in its entirety. For example, Uniform Probate Code Section 3-803C is the provision that applies non-claim provisions to claims which arise at or after the death of the decedent. The South Dakota legislature chose not to adopt that provision.
I think you're clearly correct on that. And do you have any help you can give us as to why they did not? Because I'm baffled.
No, Your Honor. I do not.
Okay.
I don't have any background on that.
We looked at the legislative history and we cannot understand why they adopted part of it for before death and then just left that empty.
I don't have any background for that either, Your Honor.
Okay.
The point is, though, that they chose not to adopt it. There is a provision that allows for non-claim provisions for in the UPC for claims which arise at or after the death of the decedent, and the South Dakota legislature chose not to adopt it, which shows the legislature's intent that they meant only for SDCL 29A-3-803 to apply only to claims which arose before death, not at or after. I think their intent is even more clear when you consider the definition of the word claim in SDCL 29A-1-2017, which outlines claims which arise at or after the death of the decedent. It shows that the legislature considered those as claims. The definition stating in pertinent part that claims in respect to the estates of decedent includes liabilities of the estate which arise at or after the death of the decedent. But again, the legislature chose not to put the language at or after the death of the decedent in 29A-3-803A, showing again that their intent was not to have that statute apply to claims which arose at or after the death of the decedent. Using this court's reasoning in MGA Insurance Co., Inc. versus Goodsell, if the South Dakota legislature had intended for SDCL 29A-3-803A to apply to claims which arose at or after the death of the decedent, they would have said so. And they didn't.
You're asking us to apply a statute of limitations, the three-year statute of limitations.
Correct.
To this claim. And the statute of limitations is, you know, there are differences between that and claim. Probate non-claim statutes. It looks like here that the legislature just has no non-claim statute. And I'm wondering whether the statute of limitations is even applicable at all. I mean, in light of the fact that it failed to adopt 803C, there's no non-claim provision here.
Correct, for claims which arose at or after the death of the decedent. I would agree with that. There are no non-claim provisions which apply to that, yes. So you're wondering if I'm hearing you correctly, if the general statute applies.
Why would a statute of limitations even apply? It's different than a non-claim statute in a probate.
Yes, Your Honor. Arguably so, Your Honor. I think that the statutes are vague in this area, and that's why we're here today. That's why the proceeding that we used is what we used, because we didn't know which, if any, statute of limitations applies. If you adopt the rule that there's not one that applies and we need to bring it within 3 years, within the term of a probate, Your Honor, we sure can file a claim against the estate if you reverse the lower court's denial of our petition. I would agree with that, Your Honor.
The status of where we're at today, there is no lawsuit filed at this point.
Correct.
Anyway, so all we're dealing with is whether or not the court was correct in not opening the period for filing claims. Is that? And there really isn't a claim filed yet.
Correct, Your Honor.
So is that the only issue then?
the issue we are dealing with on appeal is whether the lower court erred in denying our petition to extend time. The statutes are vague with regard to the scenario that we have before you today. What we basically have is we sent a letter to the estate saying, we have a potential claim we're considering filing. The estate sent us a letter back saying, your claim's barred, at the same time they closed the estate.
Well, even if we, maybe it's not an issue, but on how we write this, even if we would uphold the trial court, could you then still file the lawsuit and have it then addressed on the statute of limitations?
I would argue yes, but I would say that the statutes are vague, and if this court wants to uphold that we are within our statute of limitations within 3 years to file a claim against the estate, we will do that, Your Honor. We just didn't know how to proceed and to protect Lynn's rights and to make sure that all of his legal remedies were protected. We were basically a team in the locker room before the big game when somebody came in and said we lost and everybody was sent home. So we looked at that and said, that's a denial of our claim, even though our claim hadn't been filed. So we decided to pursue an extension of time, realizing that we may have the ability to file suit against the estate, in which we would sue the personal representative of the estate. And if this court adopts the ruling of CJS that either the general statute of limitations for us for 3 years applies, or if there is no statute of limitations and we can bring suit, we will proceed that way.
Now you said the issue is whether the trial court erred. Isn't it actually abuse of discretion?
Is the standard of review abuse of discretion? I would argue it's de novo because this is a legal issue, Your Honor.
Okay.
For more examples in this area, Florida, like the state of South Dakota, chose not to adopt UPC Section 3-803C. However, they chose to adopt Section 3-803A. C deals with non-claim provisions which apply to claims that happen at or after the death of the decedent. A, Section A, deals with non-claim provisions which apply to claims which occur before the death of the decedent. Since Florida adopted only the non-claim provisions applying to claims which arose before the death of the decedent, the Florida court in Thompson versus Hodson held that because the claimant is not making a claim or demand against the decedent's estate that arose before her death, the claim is not subject to the probate code's statute of non-claim.
But if I remember correctly, didn't that involve attorney fees or something that were incurred in estate litigation long after the death?
Yes, it was a wrongful death action, and they were pursuing a claim against a personal representative, and it was for attorney's fees. Yes.
So there's no dispute that that claim arose after death.
Correct, Your Honor. I would argue that in most of these cases where claims arise at or after the death of the decedent, there probably won't be a dispute as far as that. This is obviously an administrative attorney's fees. They're collecting administrative fees for the estate that happened after the decedent's death. But I would argue again that if our legislature intended only for actions which occurred at or after the death of the decedent to apply to administrative fees or attorney's fees, they could have said so. They could have put, let alone the non-claim provisions, applying to claims which arose at or after the death of the decedent, and they could have narrowed it further by saying it's administrative fees or attorney's fees. But they chose not to. And like in Florida, because of that, this is still a claim, even though it's for attorney's fees, which arose after the decedent's death. That's what we have here, and the Florida court held that the non-claim statutes didn't apply, and that's what we urge this court to do. So, in our discussion, if the non-claim statutes don't apply, we argue that our general statute of limitations under SDCL 15-2-14-3, which is the 3-year general statute of limitations, applies in this case. That's what the CJS on executors and administrators have held when they said where there is no controlling or applicable statute of non-claim, the general statute of limitations will be applied. We discussed why we pursued this claim through 804C. Again, it was to protect Hart's remedies because the statutes are vague. There is a provision in SDCL which we would like to recognize, SDCL 29A-3-803C2, which allows us to pursue the limitations of an insurance policy. However, that will not allow Hart to pursue claims in excess of the limits, and the insurance limits will not allow him to pursue claims of or for intentional acts or claims for punitive damages. Therefore, so that Hart could seek all of his remedies against the estate, we sought an extension of time to file our claim. We ask this court again that they reverse the lower court's denial of our petition, remand with an instruction to extend time for Hart to file a claim against the estate within the 3-year general statute of limitations.
Do we need to order the court, if we adopt your view, to extend the time, or do we need to set a statute and let you file a claim? Or is extension of time, is that the proper remedy here if we adopt your position?
Is the extension of time, if you adopt our position, the correct remedy? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
I think that's ultimately up to you. I think right now the statutes are vague in that area as far as what our correct remedy is. That's why we brought this under 804C. We obviously could potentially pursue a claim against the estate by suing the personal representative and bringing suit. And if that's the proper remedy, that's the way we will go. But not understanding which way to go, we chose 804C. And we encourage the court to adopt it or to reverse the lower court's decision, because it would eliminate some of the litigation costs. It was a cheaper way to go. But in the end, if we need to bring suit, that would be the appropriate way the court finds, we will. Addressing the motion to dismiss, there's a motion to dismiss before this court with regard to the heirs of the estate not being served with notice of the appeal. The heirs of the estate are not entitled to notice of this appeal because they are not interested persons as defined and contemplated under SDCL 29A-1-20123, as the statute relates to Hart's petition to extend time to file a claim. Under SDCL 15-26A-43, it states in general part that the appellant or his counsel shall serve upon each party, whether they're represented by counsel or to the individual person if they're pro se, the notice of appeal. This court has recently held in the estate of Geyer that if parties are not readily identified, then the substantive law in the relevant type of proceeding must be consulted to identify the parties required to be served with the notice of appeal. Now, even though Geyer is factually distinguishable, this sets out the process for cases titled in the estate of, where the parties are not readily identified. The court then went to SDCL 29A-1-401A, which states that in estate litigation, notice of any petition must be given to any interested person. SDCL 29A-1-20123 identifies interested persons in estates. It lays out terms, and then it states at the end that the meaning as it relates to a particular person's may vary from time to time and must be determined according to the particular purpose of and the matter involved in any proceeding. The particular purpose of and the matter involved in Hart's proceeding is a petition to extend time to file a claim against the estate. No claim has been filed against the estate yet. In looking at 29A-3-804, the section which describes the procedure for filing a claim against the estate, you file a claim against the estate by sending it to the personal representative, filing it with the court, sending a copy to the personal representative, or bringing suit against the personal representative of the estate. The heirs of the estate are not parties to that proceeding at that procedural juncture. That procedural juncture is between the creditor and the estate, so that the estate can determine which claims are valid, which claims will be allowed. Thank you. Which claims are valid, which claims will be allowed, and then move forward with the payment of expenses and the distribution of the estate. The heirs are not interested persons at that point, Your Honor, and therefore, because they were not interested persons, they were not entitled to receive the petition, and they were not entitled to receive the notice of this appeal. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. Mr. Woodward, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel.
Yeah, you want to raise it a little bit. There we go.
I'd like to make four main points during my presentation today. First, this court does not have jurisdiction to consider this appeal. Secondly, the appellants are attempting to raise new issues for the first time on appeal. Third, that Section 804 of the Probate Code does not apply. And finally, the record, the evidence presented in this case, does not warrant granting an extension. There's a few facts that need to be hit on. After Blair Hamilton's death, there were two petitions for appointment of a personal representative filed. One was by Wayne Lee. He was named the alternate personal representative in Blair Hamilton's will. The second petition for appointment was filed by the appellant, Lyndon Hart. He was named as the initial personal representative in the will. Mr. Hart, the appellant, was represented by attorney Patrick Kane from the very beginning in this probate proceeding. I represented Wayne Lee, the alternate named personal representative. There were other attorneys in this matter that represented other heirs. Specifically, Blair Hamilton's parents were first represented by Eric Neese of Spearfish and later represented by Tom Foy and Chuck Ryder. A hearing was held on the competing petitions for appointment.
You know, let me interrupt you right now, because there's a lot of questions that need to be asked in this case. And I frankly hope, because I'm having trouble understanding how that procedural history is relevant to the legal issues in this case. You set forth this history in your brief, and I don't understand how the competing claims to being the personal representative have anything to do with the legal issues we have to discuss.
Well, Your Honor, one of the reasons I bring it up is to show how active other parties were in this probate and how the appellant had notice and had knowledge that other parties were interested in this proceeding. And that goes towards the jurisdictional question. If I can tie that in a little bit further, Your Honor. Ultimately, the trial court determined that Lyndon Hart was unsuitable to serve as personal representative and appointed Wayne Lee as the personal representative. In that order, the court also determined there were six devisees named in Blair Hamilton's will. That order of appointment, which named the six devisees of the estate, was served upon all parties, including Mr. Hart. If you look in the trial record, that order provides the name and the address for each individual heir. Shortly after appointment...
That's a whole different animal than a creditor claim.
Yes, Your Honor.
You know, I mean, that's closer to what we said in Geyer.
Yes, Your Honor. And the reason I bring that up is because, in this case, the appellant failed to file the notice of appeal, or failed to serve the notice of appeal upon anyone except myself as attorney for the estate.
But is that wrong in the course of a creditor claim as opposed to competing claims to be the personal representative? Those are really different.
Well, with regards to the argument that Ms. Thompson raised, that a creditor's claim isn't served on the other heirs, that's not the correct analysis. In this case, there was a petition filed with the court to extend the time to file creditor's claim. And under Rule 401, as this court cited in the estate of Ginsbaugh case, in the estate of Geyer case, that all petitions, notice of all petitions, are to be served on all parties. She would like this court to just view this case with blinders on and look at the statute that says when you file a claim, you only have to file a claim with the personal representative. What's being appealed here is the denial of a petition to extend time to file a creditor's claim. And Rule 401 provides that all parties are to be provided with notice of a petition. So that's how this court should be viewing this appeal, not in the myopic sense that this was a claim that's filed and the claim only has to go to the personal representative. This is an appeal from the denial of the petition to file a creditor's claim. And all petitions are to be served upon all parties. Back to the lack of jurisdiction argument, there's six devisees named. In the estate of Geyer, which was a decision this court handed down in January, it ruled that when an appeal is filed in a probate proceeding, all parties are to be served with a notice of appeal. In the estate of Geyer, The court wrote that the heirs of an estate are parties who must be served with the notice of appeal. Notice of appeal must be served on all the heirs, and failure to serve all parties is jurisdictionally fatal and requires dismissal of the appeal. I've read the briefs in the estate of Geyer, and the same arguments that the appellant is raising in this case were raised in the Geyer case. In Geyer, they said this was an issue between the petitioner and the personal representative. The heirs weren't involved and didn't participate in that, so they are not interested persons and should not have been served. This court specifically rejected those same arguments and ruled that all heirs must be served. The court found that the heirs are parties to the probate proceedings because, one, they have a financial stake in the outcome. Two, the petition could affect the amount received by the heirs, and that the heirs could have joined or resisted the petition, even though they didn't at the trial court level. And the court specifically noted that a notice of appeal must be served on each party, not just those parties who are adversely affected. That case is indistinguishable from this case. The question of jurisdiction can be raised at any time, and not less than a week ago, this court handed down the decision in Rabel AgriFinance versus Rock Creek Farms, in which it reaffirmed the Geyer decision and again noted that all parties must be served with a notice of appeal. Failure to properly invoke this court's jurisdiction deprives this court of jurisdiction to consider the merits of an appeal. In this case, Hart did not properly invoke the court's jurisdiction, and consequently, this court lacks jurisdiction, and this case should be dismissed. As for the merits of the case, the court will note that shortly after appointment, the personal representative published a notice to creditors that advised creditors that they had 4 months to file their claims with the estate or their claims would be barred. That places the deadline for filing claims at about May 28, 2010. Mr. Hart was represented throughout the probate proceedings, and in fact, during the course of the probate, the estate filed suit against Mr. Hart to recover a judgment for money that he owed Blair Hamilton. Over a year and a half after Blair Hamilton's death, an intern from the firm that now represents Mr. Hart wrote me a letter, and that letter merely said that his firm was considering a potential claim against the estate and requested an incident report from Blair Hamilton's death and asked whether there was liability insurance. The legal intern's letter did not name the claimant, it did not explain the basis for the claim, and it did not give the amount of the claim. And the legal intern's letter was from a firm that had not appeared in the probate proceedings up to that point. I responded with a letter explaining that all claims against the estate were barred.
Is that the equivalent of a disallowance of a claim under 804?
Absolutely not. Rule 804 addresses how a claim is to be presented to an estate. A letter advising that they're investigating a potential claim of an unknown claimant for an unknown reason, for an unknown amount, does not satisfy filing a claim with an estate. Public policy requires that estates of decedents are to be speedily and finally handled. The statutes of non-claim are not intended to restrict creditors. They are enacted to expedite and facilitate the settlement of estates in the interest of public welfare and for the benefit of the interested parties in decedents' estates. This court's written that courts are not to expand the opportunities for creditors to file claims.
What does that do in this case where there's an issue about claims after or at the date of death and the statute of limitations? Do we have the issue in front of us, or is it your position that a lawsuit could still be filed and we deal with the statute of limitations?
Well, in the case before the court today, as noted in the appellant's brief, is they seek to make a claim against the assets of the estate. Whether or not a suit can be filed is not the issue before the court at this time.
Okay.
The appellant is also seeking to raise issues for the first time in this appeal. Hart's petition to extend time to file creditors' claims cites only SDCL 29A-3-804C as the basis for the requested extension. I invite the court to look at the petition itself. It's 167 in the clerk's index. And in the petition, the only thing cited is 29A-3-804C. That's the only basis that was raised at the trial court level. Any arguments beyond the application of 804C have been waived. The trial court did not consider other arguments.
What else could they do, though? I mean, they had to get an extension of time to file a claim after your letter saying the time had expired. I mean, that 804 is the only thing left to do.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that they're out of luck. That's why there's the non-claim statute. They failed to file their claim within the time provided.
Oh, I thought you were saying that this issue is not before us now. I mean, they brought an 804 request. It seems to me that the reasons for denial and anything associated with that is legitimately before us now.
804C does not provide an extension to file claims. 804C only provides an extension of time to commence a proceeding for a claim that was already filed. Okay. It's undisputed that Lyndon Hart failed to file his claim. I submit that he's conceded that the 803 timeframes weren't met. That's why they reached 804C and have now requested an extension of time. However, if you review the language in 804C, it does not apply. 804C provides that first a claim must be presented to the personal representative. Then the personal representative can either allow the claim or disallow the claim. The statute then says that if a claim is disallowed, the claimant has 60 days in which to commence a proceeding to pursue their claim. The personal representative can consent to an extension of that 60-day period, or 804C provides that upon petition, the court can grant an extension to avoid injustice. In this case, we don't have a claim, so there's no extension to be given. The court in the estate of Ginsbaugh clearly and unequivocally ruled that the relief provided by 804C only applies after a claim has been filed and after the personal representative has issued a notice of disallowance. In this case, there's been no claim filed and the personal representative has not issued a notice of disallowance. For over 100 years, it has been settled law in South Dakota that no holder of any claim against an estate may maintain an action unless the claim is first presented to and rejected by the executor. And this court ruled 100 years ago that proof of the performance of that is an essential condition to going forward with the claim. Clearly, 804C does not apply. And this court has ruled that the courts are not to expand a creditor's opportunity to make claims against an estate. Finally, another reason that the trial court should be affirmed is there's no evidence to support an extension. If this court were to determine that 804C provides a basis that allows an extension, there's no evidence in the record to support any such extension. As I've said, there's been no claim filed. There's no evidence in the record of any medical diagnosis. There's no evidence in the record of the date of any diagnosis, or that any diagnosis has been made or who it's been made by. There's been no evidence that any diagnosis is related to Blair Hamilton's death. The appellant has argued that there's post-traumatic stress disorder, but nothing in the record supports anything regarding post-traumatic stress. In their brief, the appellants cite to their brief to the trial court. The trial court had no evidence to support any finding that there's any diagnosis. Also, 804C provides that the court can grant an extension upon petition to avoid injustice. There's no evidence in the record of any injustice that would be avoided by allowing the claim. Precedent in South Dakota shows that non-claim statutes are intended to give finality to probate proceedings and to allow the personal representative to close estates without the risk of liability for having overlooked a legitimate debt or claim. To grant an extension based upon this record would seriously jeopardize the orderly administration of estates in South Dakota. More than 2.5 years have passed since Blair Hamilton's death. All bills of the estate have been paid and all assets distributed. The estate is closed. Since that time, one major beneficiary has died and those assets have been redistributed. It would be a grave miscarriage of justice to allow Lindenhart to bring a claim more than 2.5 years after Blair Hamilton's death. Perhaps more importantly, to allow such a claim to be brought would reverse over 100 years of legal precedent in South Dakota. In Murray versus Johnson in 1912, this court recognized that it was essential that the claim first be filed with the personal representative and either presented or rejected by the executor before a claim could proceed. Again, courts cannot broaden the creditor's opportunity to present a claim against a state, and we ask the court to, number one, dismiss this appeal because the court lacks jurisdiction. And if the court finds it has jurisdiction, we'd ask for the court to affirm the trial court. Thank you, Your Honor.
I have one more question. Assuming that we don't adopt your position, is there any dispute in your view that a claim for post-traumatic stress syndrome arises at or after death?
I would dispute that if such a claim arose, it arose prior to death.
Well, if it's post-traumatic stress, how can it be before death? If the traumatic event was this individual shooting himself.
Well, again, I don't know what the alleged claim is for, whether it is what part of anything. There were references made in the trial court to the trial court that it may arose from things that occurred before death and after death, but we don't know. There's nothing, no evidence in the record to fill out what their claim is. So I don't think the post part of it is reference to the death. It's the event that allegedly caused the disorder. But again, we have nothing in the record to support their claim that a disorder exists.
Thank you, Mr. Gruber.
Thank you.
Ms. Thompson, you have 10 minutes.
Let me just move that down again. Thank you. Mr. Gruber is jumping ahead in this case. No claim has been filed against the estate, so no evidence is in the record of this claim, and we're not required to prove that claim yet. The issue out there is that we have a potential claim against the estate. And how do we file that claim against the estate, which appears to have no non-claim provisions applicable to it, when the estate has told us you've lost and everybody's been sent home? Our best result was to file a petition to extend time under 804C, seeing his letter from the estate as a disallowance of our potential claim. That's what we chose to do.
You know, maybe you should have filed a claim and fleshed it out a little bit as to what it was and let him formally deny it, because it doesn't appear the letter from the intern is sufficient to satisfy the definition of a claim.
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree. The letter from the intern is not sufficient to satisfy a claim. And maybe we should have, but the same day that the attorney from the estate sent us the letter that our claim is barred, the estate was closed. So I would argue we didn't have a chance to even file a claim against the estate. If the team would have still been there for us to play, we would have marched out of the locker room and played the game and determined who won. The team and everybody else had gone home. So we did what we thought we could through 804C, in bringing the petition to extend time to file our claim. and bringing it before a court so that we could get an ultimate decision rather than a decision made between the two parties. I would also argue that Guyer is the law is applicable, and Guyer says look to the substantive law of the proceeding in which you're looking. The attorney for the estate brings up, Mr. Gugu brings up the recent case of Rock Creek Farms. However, I believe the court in that case held that there's no unique circumstances like in Ray Reese, where we were trying to determine who the parties were. The parties were listed, so all parties should have been served. In this case, again, we have an estate case where all parties are not identified. Because of that, we look to the substantive law of probate. We look to 401. We look to 401A to say that all interested persons are to be served with petitions. The definition of interested persons says that it can change. It can vary related to each individual person because of the particular purpose involved and the particular purpose in the matter involved. Again, in this case, that particular purpose and the matter involved was we were trying to file a claim against the estate. We're trying to get an extension of time to file that claim. At that point, at that procedural juncture, the heirs are not interested persons in which they are entitled to a petition, nor are they entitled to notice of appeal. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson.